In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Rob and I are going to be talking about SaaS development shortcuts. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 342. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products. Whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it, I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's going on this week, Rob?
It's been a good week, and it's Memorial Day weekend coming up. So we are flying to California for a couple days, just like a 3 or 4 day trip to see some folks. And yeah, just kind of looking forward to it. We haven't been on a trip for, well, I guess since MicroConf, which was what, maybe 6 weeks ago. I guess that's not that long ago, but looking forward to getting some sun. And it's also nice and warm up where we're going, so kind of just easing into it. Yeah. How about you?
I have to go see a specialist and have some x-rays taken because I might have a torn rotator cuff.
That is such a bummer. Oh man.
I know. And I mean, it's not bad. It's like, if it's a tear, it's really small and they think that it's not bad enough that where they look at it and say, yes, this is obviously a tear. It might just be inflamed and some other stuff. So they're going to start with some x-rays and see if there's any fluid buildup or some bone spurs or something like that. And if that comes back kind of inconclusive, then they'll move on and do like a whole shoulder MRI and see what comes out of that.
Yeah, that's a bummer. So then they could, of course, if they find it, then they have to do surgery and then you're like, not able to type with that arm for a while.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they also said that because of, like, I still have good range of motion, it just hurts when I move in certain positions, that physical therapy might be something that they could work with, or anti-inflammatories or various other things. But I'm hoping that I can dodge that surgery bullet, to be honest. It's not something I want to go through.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's always a bummer to get hurt. And, you know, nowadays when I get injured, it's not like we're that old, but it's like I remember getting injured running track when I was, you know, 21, and you just heal quick, right? Your body's in really good shape and you're younger. And then these types of things now, it's going to take you a while to like get over that. I know, you know, you've also had back issues where it's like this stuff, you just don't heal as well as you did, you know, 20 years ago or whatever.
Yeah. And that actually came to mind. It's like, I'm not as young as I used to be. I just don't heal as quickly. And, you know, back then, you know, in your 20s, you can take the bumps and bruises and shake them off and you'll be back at it the next day. And this is just like that dull ache. And I'm like, oh, this is just going to go on and on.
Oh yeah, totally. Cool. So what else? What are we talking about this week?
Well, today we're going to be talking about SaaS development shortcuts. And I kind of pulled some of this from my MicroConf talk. And the basic idea is that there were some parts of my talk where I had highlighted where there are gaps between what we think needs to be done versus what really needs to be done. And in these places, there's some shortcuts that you can take to avoid doing work now that you could presumably do later. And some of it you can just avoid indefinitely. But there's other pieces of it that you can push off to the future because it's going to either take a lot of work, or there's going to be a long time for you to see any results or benefits from doing that work. And there's workarounds that you can put in place to avoid doing it now. And in some cases, you'll take on some technical debt or some other types of work debt that you can just have to defer, really. But by doing so, it allows you to concentrate on the more important things now versus delaying like your launch or delaying getting sales or, you know, just delaying moving your product further than it would if you took the month or 3 months or whatever to implement the things that you were looking at.
Yeah, and there's a lot of these trade-offs that go into building any type of software, that go into building any type of business. A lot of things that you have to think about and think to yourself, do we have to do this now? Can we push it off? And if we push it off, is it, you know, does it create more of a hassle later on? Does it create more debt later on? Or, and not monetary debt, obviously, but like technical or business debt? Or is it the same amount? You know, is it the same amount in 3 months if I build the knowledge base today? If I build the knowledge base in 6 months, is it the same amount of work versus when you're in code, if you take a shortcut, we all know that technical debt will actually get worse over time. And so there's some of these get worse if you don't do them, and some, you know, stay the same, or maybe it's a linear progression. And these are the kinds of things you have to think about as you're trying to figure out what you can delay.
So what we're going to do is we're going to walk around some of the different things that we might think that we need, but could be delayed with various workarounds. And we'll talk about what some of those workarounds entail. And then we'll talk about some of the things that are really difficult to find workarounds for. And then we're going to dive into some general guidelines for deciding how to push things off and whether or not you should do them now or schedule them in the near future, or kind of how to prioritize some of them. So to kick things things off with the things that we might think that we need. The first one is a sales website. And it's interesting that I ran into this where my traditional thinking all along has kind of been, oh, okay, you need a sales website in order to sell your product, to tell people what it is, what it does, how it works, how they would use it, what the value is. And what I realized that is that if you're doing direct sales with people, you don't have to do any of that. You can get away with a lot less than you need to. Right now, for example, I've got Bluetick up over 20 customers, around 20 to 25 right now. And I still only have, I think, 3 pages on my website. And one of them is a privacy policy. And the other one's a terms of service. And the third one is just the landing page where it basically kind of gives you an overview of what it does and asks you for an email address, either to sign up to get an invitation code or to join the mailing list and go through like a 5-part email course. That's it. And I've got to this point really without having a website.
Yep. And this is an easy one when you're doing direct sales. We did the same thing with Drip. I wasn't even doing direct sales, but it was bringing onboarding is really what I think about it as. It's like people wanted to try. I was doing emails back and forth. And all we had was still that landing page for months and months of onboarding. And we did the same thing, got into the high teens, low 20s in terms of customers that way. So this is definitely, you know, given that you're still probably trying to find product market fit at this point, it almost doesn't make sense to build a website out because you don't really know what your positioning is. You don't know what your feature set is. You know, this is still early customer development. So I think there's a lot better places your time can be spent than going and trying to hack together some entire website.
And the interesting part about all the stuff that you just said is that because you don't know what to put on the website, most of it's probably going to be wrong anyway. So going that direct sales route allows you to have the conversations and get people's feedback and understand truly what it is that they are trying to solve for and what the terminology is that they use and what resonates with them. And then once you have done that enough, you get to a certain point where then it makes more sense to build the sales website because you have enough information from those conversations to be able to build something that is going to be effective in pitching towards people that don't know who you are and you haven't had a referral or had no conversations or had nothing explained to them. That's really the position that it puts you in. And that really leads into the second one, which is marketing automation. And I think people look at marketing and automation as a panacea for all types of sales problems. But the reality is that it's very difficult to automate a sales process when you don't even know what it is that people think yet or what they're really looking for. And that's what that direct sales approach is going to solve for you.
Yeah, I agree there too. I mean, as much of a proponent as I am of email marketing and marketing automation in general, which is just a more advanced form of email marketing, it's just too early at this point, right? And until you hit the point where you really do feel like, you know, you have a good idea of your positioning and you're going to start to feel like you know what content people need in order to understand your product. There's going to hit a point where it's like, oh, everyone's kind of, there are questions about how to use the product, but there's also questions about like the higher level architecture, like what are best practices for sales nurturing? That's what you're going to get, Mike. Or we kept getting, what are best practices for email automation or marketing automation? How do I structure my tags and what should I use custom fields for? And how is this different than email marketing? And it's higher level stuff. That's the kind of stuff that you're going to either be sending to people via email or you're going to start pushing some blog posts out at some point. And that's at the point where I think you should tip into, now I'm going to actually add lead nurturing stuff and build some workflows and start doing behavior tagging, because at that point, you just have such a better idea of where your business is. And it's almost a waste of time if you only have, you know, 100 website visitors, or you only have 20 customers. You really need to get to the point where you're getting 500 or 1,000 uniques a month, to where you're getting at least a handful of new subscribers to kind of go through go through that stuff.
Now, the caveat here is that marketing automation is a very broad term, and it doesn't mean that there aren't certain tactics that you can pull out of the marketing automation playbook that would be beneficial for you. So, for example, I just saw that Drip sent out an email with a pointer to a mechanism used by Christoph Engelhardt, who's a good friend of the show, comes to MicroConf Europe, has taken notes for MicroConf Europe as well. And in that article, he went over the idea of using Drip to send an email to people after you've captured their email address to pull them back and help with abandoned shopping cart emails. And those are the types of things that's a tactic that you can use to help pull people back to your website. I actually use it for Bluetick right now, where if somebody goes in, they request an invitation code, it pops them over to a survey page. And if they don't fill out the survey page, it sends them an email from Drip about 10 minutes later. And my hope and intent is that they will fill out the survey because they're right there. But if they don't, then they get a follow-up email from Drip a little while later. And interestingly enough, I got an email earlier this week from somebody saying, hey, how did you do that? Because I'd love to know a little bit more information about it. And we actually have a demo scheduled here pretty soon. But it's tactics like that that can really help. You don't have to go out and implement everything that's marketing automation related, but there are certain tactics that you can pull from it.
You know, another thing that I tend to push off, because it's that whole, it doesn't get harder to do this in 3 or 6 months, it doesn't build debt, is documentation. At first, when you're doing hand onboarding, you're doing direct sales, really the documentation that I had was the emails back and forth with people. And I just started gathering those up and keeping them first it was an FAQ doc, and then I realized some of them needed to really be fleshed out. And that was the best way to kick off our knowledge base. So first there was nothing. And then as soon as we got to the point where I knew we were going to be emailing several thousand people on our launch list, I knew we needed something. And so what I did is, knowing that writing documentation was going to take forever, I went in and I recorded about, I'll say maybe somewhere between 8 and 12 screencasts. And they're Camtasia, you know, 3 to 5 minute screencasts where I walk through, this is what a campaign is, this is, you know, just basic stuff, this is what broadcast is, this is what this setting does. There wasn't a ton in the app. And I just slapped up, again, those, you know, 8 to 12 KB articles. It was in a WordPress. There's like a WordPress theme, I think, that allows you to make a KB. And I just put them up there. And that's it. We had 8, 9, 10 KB articles at the start. And screencasts are not the ideal way to consume that. It was very fast for me to make them. But within the first few months, people were saying, oh, I really want to be able to read through them. Or I was at the airport and the Wi-Fi was bad and I couldn't play them. And so over time, I actually paid someone to turn those screencasts into documents. And, or, you know, into like actual KB articles. And so that's the progression though, right? It's like, you don't need to write all the documentation up front. It would be great if you could, but you just don't have the time. So that's the idea, is you start with nothing and it really is just manual, and you're going to have more support up front because of that. But then you move into something lighter. For me, that was screencast. For you, maybe something different. And then ultimately you build that out over time.
The next item on the list for something you can push off until later is a billing system. And it sounds like a billing system is probably not something you want to push off, because you want to be able to start getting revenue as quickly as possible. But there are hacks around having a billing system in place. So instead of having like an automated billing process in place, you could send people manual invoices. There's tons of different pieces of software out there that allow you to send somebody an invoice and then have them pay you. I mean, you could easily do something like that through PayPal. You could send them a PayPal invoice once a month. And yes, that doesn't scale, but that's not the point. The point is to allow you to avoid building out that billing system until you get to a point where it is difficult for you to keep up. Another thing that you could do is you could manually enter people's credit cards into Stripe using the back end, or there's a WordPress plugin called WP Simple Pay, which is from Phil Dirksen, who's also a MicroConf attendee and friend of ours, who that WordPress plugin can be used to capture those credit cards and help you with that stuff without you being involved directly in taking the credit card and entering it in. So if you want to automate some things a little bit, as Rob said, there's that natural progression. Like over time, you can add more and more things into it until you get to a point where it is fully automated and helps you move things forward. But until you need it, there's no point in spending a lot of time doing it, because the billing system can be very, very complicated. And at the start, you don't need all that complexity.
Yeah, you know, with Drip, we didn't actually use any of those approaches. We just had like a little Rails script that Derek cranked up, and I think it took him like less than a day. We wound up building that like 5 days before the first billing was going to run. So we were signing people up, and I think we had a 30-day trial. And so we got like 25 days into the trial, and I'm like, all right, Derek, we got to get something that's going to bill people in a couple days and put it on a cron. And it was super simple at first, right? It was literally, this is an amount, and this is how much you're getting billed. And then again, over the next coming months, it's like you have the upgrade and the automatic downgrade and prorating, and, you know, whatever else goes along with it. We built that into it, but we started pretty simple. And I agree, you don't need as much logic as you think you do in the early days in billing.
One of the more common things that you probably need to implement in a SaaS application is a permission system. And depending on whether you're going to do it like a single tenant or multi-tenant model on the back end, you may need to implement permissions inside the system to allow certain people to access some resources and then prevent others from accessing those same resources. And, you know, this can get very, very complicated, especially if you get into the idea of having group accounts and, you know, some people with certain roles or permissions. Again, there's lots of white papers and documentation you could read out there about different ways of implementing a permission systems or a claim system. And it does get complicated, but in the early days, you really don't need any of that. All you need is the ability for somebody to log in and see their data and not see somebody else's. You don't need to create all this additional complexity with groups and roles and permissions and stuff like that. You could really just get started with one user. Now, to Rob's point earlier, there are certain types of debt that you're taking on. And in this case, it's a technical debt. And that can be difficult to get around. But in the early days, if you need to get around that just to help prove out the idea and make sure that things are working and people are getting value out of the app, this is one of the shortcuts that you can take. But you have to be forewarned that it is technical debt that you're taking on when you use this approach. But it could be what you need to do.
Yeah, when we first launched Drip, it was just one login, and then people wanted to invite whatever teammates. And so then we had to add the ability to just have additional folks. And the only thing we had was like owner, and I think we just called it an admin or something was the other role. And then 6-12 months down the line, we kept getting requests for like, well, I don't want some people to mess with our settings. So then we added like a member, right? It's just, there's three tiers, owner, admin, member. And we have been able to maintain that. And I mean, we are tens of thousands of users and 4 years into a pretty substantial SaaS app. We do get periodic requests to add more granular stuff. And we've started talking about that internally, what that would look like. But the good thing is now we really understand our customer. We really understand our audience. And we have had enough requests for it, asking in different ways, like I want people to be able to come in but not export anybody, or not be able to view my subscribers, or not be able to send anybody. You know, there's all these different things. So we're not making it up in a vacuum. It's not like we just dream up how we think they might use it. We have real usage patterns and real feature requests. So I'm very much in agreement with you on this one. If you need multiple logins, that's fine. But as soon as you get to like anything granular at all, I would punt that so far down the line, unless that's like a core competency of your app, which I'm guessing it's not going to be.
Yeah, one thing that I recently did was I kind of repurposed our impersonation mechanism and applied it to people's accounts to let them have multiple users inside the same account. And it works fine. You know, it's not great. There's certainly a lot of work that needs to be done there. But for the time being, it allows people to use the product and have different logins physically associated with the same account. And, you know, it's like I said, it's a trade-off, but it does work. And early on, your customers are probably going to be pretty understanding about that stuff.
Another one is password reset and account management type stuff. You know, it's a lot of time to implement versus the actual number of minutes anyone's going to use it, or the number of times someone's going to use it in the first 3 months of your app. So I know that pretty sure we had like a reset password button, and I think it may have just like fired off an email to us or something that's like reset my password. It may even have just led to the contact form, something crazy. This is very, very early on. You're at 20, 30, 40 customers. You're going to get one a week, and you can just do it manually and people understand. And it's not until you go a little broader, you know, and again, you're going to really start to scale up that you need to build this out.
Funny enough that I had mentioned this in my MicroConf talk as well, but the password reset in Bluetick did not work at all for 9 months. And we implemented it probably like 6 months ago, but it did not work for the longest time. And we would just go in and manually do it if somebody came back and said, hey, my password reset didn't work. And it was just literally only three people who had asked in those 9 months. So it's one of those really low frequency things that is important and needs to be taken care of, but you can manually handle it if need be. And I did have a manual back end where I could go in and I could reset somebody's password. They just couldn't do it themselves. The next one is a big thing, which is reporting. And I think in most cases, the challenge with reporting is that unless your app is specifically designed to provide reporting services for somebody, then you can probably get away with very little reporting in the first version. And most of the reason that you would want to punt this down the road is because you don't necessarily know what people want to be reporting on. And as you have conversations with people, you're going to learn more about it. But when you are initially looking at building reports, you're kind of guessing at what people want. And it's just not going to be helpful to you because you're going to build a bunch of things. People are going to say, hey, could you do this instead? And so now you've built a bunch of things that essentially you have to support longer term because you've already built them and put them in the app. And people are kind of expecting that those things are probably going to stick around. But now you've got all this legacy code there and it wasn't really what people were looking for anyway. And I think that in most cases, it's best to just put this down the road and not bother with it initially. I think Heaton and Stelly had done a recent episode in the startup chat where they talked about killing features, and you can kill features like this. But, you know, if you only have two reports, it's really hard to take away one of them.
Another thing you can push off to get further down the road is kind of the classic marketing strategies, you know, the ones that require long iteration cycles, higher workloads like SEO and content marketing. And these are things that they take a long time to ramp up to. So it's not something you should push off so long, right? Because it's not like you're going to launch a blog and then start getting traction with either content marketing or SEO immediately. But again, when you are under that 50-person mark, it's just not something that you want to scale to. If you're not doing these other things of building a password reset and building a billing system, you're not there yet. You don't actually want to drive this type of kind of cold traffic to your site. And so, you know, everyone talks about it, but it really, they talk about this, they talk about split testing. These are things that you need to do later on. You need to wait until you're starting to scale up marketing and you feel like the app's at a place when it can really onboard, app and your team is at a place where you can really onboard people, you have documentation, and you're ready to kind of start dealing with really new users to see how they come in and how they get onboarded and how they convert.
The next one is new feature development. And the kind of rule of thumb that I've taken lately is that unless I get a certain number of people asking for something or saying that it's important, or if they're not a customer yet and they say that, well, I need this in order to be able to sign on and it's a deal breaker to them, I generally push that off to the side in favor of other things that more people have asked for or, you know, are a higher priority because it's not something that is being asked for a lot. So therefore, it's just less important than those other things. And I'm not going to spend my time building something that very few people are going to use, or it's not going to be used very often. And instead, I'll spend my time working on those things that people are going to use a lot, that are getting asked for a lot, because those are clearly most important. And the other ones are stuff that they're nice to have. Sometimes it's just people are asking a question because they want to know the answer to it, you know, not because they're actually interested in using it. And that's an interesting side note that I've discovered is when somebody asks you something, a great way to kind of deflect the question is to ask them if it's important to them. And they'll tell you, sometimes they'll just say, no, I was just asking, I was just wondering. But if you have that developer mindset where like, how do I solve problem X that somebody just presented me, you can very easily find yourself going off into the weeds and trying to do something that's going to take you a while to do when the person was just asking. They just wanted to know because they were curious, not because they needed it. The last one is being able to provide real-time results for people. And this kind of delves into partially about reporting, but also if you need to do any sort of complex calculations or you're not sure how you're going to get the data from one place to another and it needs to be done manually for the time being until you get to a point where you automate it. This could be any sort of situation like if you have to deal with a government website, for example, and you have to feed data into it, those are notoriously terrible when it comes to like APIs and being able to send data into them. A lot of times you have to resort to various hacks like, you know, using Selenium to automate a browser to go plug in all the different fields and stuff. Instead of doing that, hire somebody to go in and like type in stuff that customers have entered. You've made it easy for them to either import the data or put stuff in a way that makes sense. And then you have somebody go in and type it all in. And most people would say, well, this is a SaaS application that should be real time, but it doesn't need to be. Most of the time, you know, when you're looking at those types of things, there's customer expectations about how long it should take. And then there's also what they really need it returned to them in, you know, and if the time period is like a 24 or 48 hour window, it's probably not that big a deal unless your whole value proposition is that it is automated and very fast. In those types of cases, you probably have to do all the legwork and automation up front. But a lot of times you can get away with just pushing it down the road. And then once it gets to a scale where you can't handle it or it is costing you far too much to not have it automated, that's when you go down that path.
Now let's take a look at three things that are difficult to get around, things that you're going to have to implement upfront and the things that you should be focusing on. The first one are the core parts of your value proposition, things like features, reports, if they're absolutely needed, automation, if that's really what your app does. Without this, you don't really have much of value, right? I mean, this is probably the core piece of finding product market fit and building something people want is you should be focusing on the features that are driving value for your prospects and customers.
The next one is probably a judgment call, but I find that user impersonation is really difficult to get around. You can use screen sharing. So if somebody runs into a problem, you can get on a call with them using a variety of different tools and share their screen and look at it is that they're seeing. But that type of thing is impossible to do without the other person being present and allowing you to essentially watch them as they log in and go do whatever it is. And it's a lot easier in many cases to have an impersonation mechanism in place so that you can, you know, flip a flag on your account or in the database directly and just say, hey, log me in as that person. And then you will be able to see exactly what they would see. And if they come back and they say they have questions about how do I do this or how do I do that or why is this showing up in my account in this way, it allows you to go into their account, take screenshots, and then send them those screenshots or do a screencast and explain to them what it is that they're seeing. And if you're seeing data that shouldn't be there, then it's a lot easier to do it without the customer present and having you say, why is this there? I don't understand myself. And we wrote it. You know, you're in a much better position if you have that impersonation ability.
By impersonation, you mean like being able to log in as one of your customers. Is that right?
Yes.
And see the app as them?
Yep.
Yeah, totally agree. This is a huge one. We call it ghosting. You ghost in as them. But it's incredible to be able to see the app as your customers and see exactly what they need. And if you don't have that ability, it's like you're digging through raw data. They'll send you a bug and you can't reproduce it. But it's like as soon as you can log in as them, it's a big deal. This is something I would build very, very early on. And the third one that's difficult to get around is not having any type of sales channel. Like you need to be able to get to customers somehow. So referrals can be one. You know, this direct sales model, you could be doing outbound cold outreach. You could just have an email list of 50 people and you kind of email them one at a time and you're bringing them in. None of those are scalable, but at least, I shouldn't say none are scalable, cold outreach is. But you need some type of sales channel to be bringing people in for this to be worth it. And so that you can get the feedback, you can get a little bit of revenue, and that you can start building something that you hope a broader audience wants.
Actually, emailing them individually, that's what Bluetick does. Like it allows you to iterate through those people and email them individually as if it was coming directly from you. And you can very quickly go through large numbers of people. It's for like that personalized automation at scale. But I agree, like it's difficult if you don't have a sales channel at all. Like you can't do that with five people.
That's Bluetick.io, ladies and gentlemen.
So now we're going to move on to general guidelines for deciding what to push off. And there's a couple of different criteria you can look at. And the first one is there a manual workaround of some kind? And it doesn't need to be something that is quick and easy or automated. If it takes like writing SQL and running it against the database manually for an individual customer to do those types of things, then it counts as a manual workaround. It doesn't mean that it's easy, but if it's easier to do that than it is to spend a week or two writing code, then, you know, chances are good that you can start with that and not have to go through that couple of weeks of writing code that may not be used very often. And that leads directly into the second thing, which is it's not something that you or a customer would do very often. If it's not used very much, then there's no real point in automating it and writing the code to do those operations.
And another guideline for thinking about when to push stuff off is if it's going to take a long time to automate, there are even things that happen, you know, fairly frequently that if it's like 2 or 3 months of dev time to implement, you might still be doing manually or having someone on your team do manually 1-3 years into your business. So it's always a balance. And if you can build 2 killer features in 2 months, or you can build this one background task that only happens once a week or once a day or 5 times a day, like there really is a balance to human automation versus code automation. Another guideline that leads right into is you're not really sure what to automate, right? If you have some stuff that seems like it takes manual time, but you don't know how to automate it, or you're not sure exactly how that would work, then that's a good reason to kind of push this off. Because what I've found is things, they do become clearer over time. The more people you get, the more customers you get, and the further along your app gets, things just mature and it becomes easier to tell how to automate things and what you should automate.
And the last situation where you should consider pushing something off is if it's a feature or a task that different customers are going to want different things or are probably going to want different things. And this is kind of where reporting falls square into this bucket. But there's certainly other things where if there's a presentation layer over the top of the data that customers might say, well, I want to see these columns versus those columns, or I want to be able to filter certain things out of the data right on the screen. Those are the situations where you can take the stance that, well, here it is out of the box, and we will get to those things down the road when they become more important or when enough people ask for them. But because different customers are going to have those different requirements or different needs around it, you can build a lot of customization around presenting data, but people are going to want different things. And it can take you a long time to build those, even just those individual pieces.
I think that about wraps us up for the day. If you have a question for us, you can call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups and visit startupsfortherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thank you for listening. We will see you next time.